The Second World War is the largest event in human history.
A 20-part series with Tom Hanks.
No part of the globe was untouched. No life unchanged.
Experience the ultimate account of World War II.
Every single person had a story. These are the stories that make us who we are.
Listen to World War II with Tom Hanks on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
In 1919, he hit 29 home runs and was sold to the New York Yankees.
A three-run home run for Buffington. The Yankees now lead it by a score of 3-2.
Bill Lee is now going over to a couple of the Yankees, and there they go again.
Swan hits it to deep left. That might send the Yankees to the World Series.
Varitek and A-Rod going at it. Roberts is going. Posada's throw. Roberts, safe.
And what can I say? Just dip my hat and call the Yankees my daddy.
Welcome to Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. Brian Shack with John Senecal here with you on episode 68. I mean, we said it in some ways, it was almost teasable, like it was the Moonlight Graham episode, but it's really not the case. I mean, anyone who knows baseball knows Moonlight Graham. You know, it's from Field of Dreams.
Chisholm, Minnesota.
Yeah, and he got into one game, but he never got to bat.
But he did get to walk into a cornfield.
No, I mean, you know, it's, you know, I first read the book. I mean, I remember it was, I think W.P. Kinsella is the author. I read the book in, I think, 1988. And I think the movie came out soon thereafter. I mean, the book was a big deal to me. But everyone who knows baseball knows Moonlight Graham. But Earl Snyder's not Moonlight Graham.
No.
And we've been talking to Mr. Snyder for a long time now. You have, especially to try to get him on the show. And he joins us here on episode 68. Just for a little bit of background, Earl Snyder is a police officer in Connecticut. He's a resident, born and raised in Connecticut, high school star, went to the University of Hartford, played baseball. We'll get into his baseball career, obviously. And I think the crux of today is to talk a little bit about his role on the 2004 Red Sox. But first of all, Earl, thanks for coming on.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, you know, and you came on our my morning radio show to talk a little bit about this on Monday, but you're a cop and you're an ex-pro baseball player. Like, do people know? Because to me, like, you made the bigs. Like, I don't care. No one's ever going to take that away from you. Like, you were a Major League Baseball player. And do people now, obviously you bust some dude, he doesn't know, but do people around you know who you are?
Well, know who I am. That's funny.
You know, do you know who I am?
Yeah, that's the worst question ever. I hate that question. But
good start, no, Brian. Yeah.
No. That do you know who I am question. I get it all the time at work, but it's one of those things where I don't bring it up. I kind of just will get ribbed every once in a while by my coworkers. They'll bring it up to some stranger that's there that we're dealing with or anything like that. But I really don't bring it up. I'm not afraid or adverse to talking about it at all. But it's one of those things where I never initiate that part of my life.
But let's be honest. Everybody, like your son and everybody in town wants you coach. They're on your team, your son's team. You're coaching it, right?
So
you got
as best I can.
All right. So the line's out the door for to get on his kid's team. I'm guessing,
right? Because he's a former major leaguer.
You know who I am.
Yeah. I mean, is it? Yeah. I mean, of course that makes total sense.
I mean, if I'm in town, like his friend Brian, he played baseball with him at University of Hartford. Like I didn't know Brian until my son wound up on Brian's team, and like within like one practice, I was like, hallelujah, my son is on Brian's team.
Right.
Like I figured it out real quick how lucky I was, and then next thing I know, like my other son winds up on Brian's team, and then next year, the next year. It's just funny how that works. You know what I mean?
You know, I think your story has, before we get to 04, I think your story has so many things that are honestly like kind of inspiring in a lot of different ways. Just take people through. So you went to Plainville High School in Connecticut, and you said you were good, but not great, right? You didn't get it. It wasn't like Mississippi State was calling you to go play college baseball, right?
No, not at all. It was one of those things where, unlike now with our kids going to these camps and clinics and travel ball and all this other stuff. We didn't have that back then.
Right, you actually played Little League, right?
Yeah, you played Little League and you played in high school and you might play a American Legion ball or something. But other than that, during the the winter months and everything else, you played a different sport, or you clowned around with your friends, or you did whatever.
You weren't hitting baseballs 24/7, 365.
No, and that's...
I liked it better that you played three sports, probably.
Yeah, well, no, I only played one sport because I was lazy, but it was one of those things that was... I had some good hand-eye coordination, I had a little power, and that ended up coming out in college because I actually stopped being lazy and actually did start working out and practicing every day, and those talents, whatever you want to call them, were amplified at that point because I finally did something more than 3 or 4 months out of the year.
So there's no major league or team sniffing at you in high school, but you go to college and you work your butt off.
Yeah, definitely not in high school.
And you get drafted.
Yeah, ultimately got drafted after my senior year by the Mets in the 36th round.
36?
Yeah, nosebleed section.
Nice. Yeah, well, they don't even have a 36th round now.
No, I mean, that's better than Piazza, though. Piazza was lower than that.
68th or something like that. I mean, so you're not totally nosebleed. You're middle tier.
But there's no expectation you're going to make the majors with that draft pick. What do they pick you as? Are you... like, what are their expectations for you?
Probably a roster filler for the minor leagues, like the lower minor leagues, I would imagine, you know, because at that point I'm older because I'm not out of high school, not even a junior in college. You know, after your senior year, you have no leverage at all. It's either you want to play or you want to go get a job. It's like, yeah, I'll play, you know. And that's kind of how it worked. I went to Pittsfield, Massachusetts for...
and the New York Penn League, sure.
New York Penn League, yeah, for that half season. And after that season, I actually went back down to Florida after that to instructional league. They kind of picked a couple of us to go there. And
okay, so you're infantry. They're feeding you to the dogs, right? They're just going to play until you get sick of it, and then they'll have another 36-rounder to come in and play. So that's basically how it goes. When did you know, or when did they realize that maybe it was different?
I don't know. I know the second, my first full year.
Did you go for 3 for 5 in Altoona and everything changed?
No, that's how I ended up with the... I think my theory is that's how I ended up with the Indians. But I think it was after my first full season, I ended up getting like the MVP of the team or whatever it was, some little award that they gave. And then you went to Shea Stadium and they handed it out before a game. You know, and then it happened again the next year when I was in the Florida State League. And then... by the time I was in Double A, that after that year, I got the organizational player of the year, like those 3 years in a row. So it was one of those things where it progressively got better. You know, you make an all-star team or two, and it was one of those things where you proved you belonged with the first rounders and the other guys that were way better athletes than I was.
At this point, though, you're like 24, 25. Almost,
older,
right?
Oh, older. Yeah. Let's see. That was...
yeah,
around
2000,
so I was probably 24 years old, 25, yeah, somewhere in there. So,
are the Mets like, oh, this guy's doing it again? Like, are they annoyed by it, or are they finally thinking you're an asset?
No, I would imagine that's the way it came, and you know, the Mets, they were great. I mean,
first of all, what position did you play?
I played corners mostly, but in the beginning, you know, I got drafted as a first baseman. You know, 6 foot, 185 pounds at the time. Imagine 185 pounds. I haven't seen that in a while, but it's one of those things where, you know, I was playing there and knowing that, you know, at the time, like Jason Giambi is the first baseman of you know, he's the guy, and I look nothing like him, and I'm like, there's just no way that, you know, so I'm gonna have to change positions maybe. And I hit well enough the first couple of years where I was told Bobby Valentine with the Mets at the time, liked guys that played multiple positions. So they moved me and started putting me at third base, putting me in left field a little bit to kind of, you know, see if I could at least play adequate enough defense to be an asset somewhere.
So you get to AAA with the Mets?
I went up there for the playoffs, but no, after my AA season, that's when I got traded I was in a deal with Roberto Alomar, came back to the Mets, and I went over to the Indians with a handful.
He was a player to be named later.
Yeah.
Well, I wasn't named later. I was named in it. And we all stunk as we went over there. So it was.
So you go to Cleveland. You start off in AAA?
Yeah, in Buffalo.
Okay. So you're with the Bisons. And this is what? What year are we talking now?
2001.
That would be 2002. Yeah.
Okay. And so what happens next?
I was there for 3 weeks. You know, that it was a weird spring because that was my first spring training. With the big league camp, and I was excited to go, but at the same time, my mother was was sick with cancer and ended up passing away in spring training. So it was kind of like one of those things where it was a bittersweet, you know, obviously, you know, what I had going on at home, but ended up going back to spring training, had a decent spring, and then after 3 weeks in Buffalo,
Weeks in Buffalo.
Freezing. It was miserable. It's just right off the lake, all the cold air coming in. It's rough up there, especially in the beginning of the year. But I got called up, and you know, we had Jim Thome was playing the first base, and Travis Fryman. It was his last year, so Travis was getting older and needed to get spelled, and so I was playing first and third at that point. And Jim's back hurt, or Pedro was pitching, and then he would take the night off. Yeah.
And so your numbers, you were up for, I think it was 18 games. You hit 200. You hit that one dong. You remember it? Can you tell us?
Oh, yeah. Who'd you hit it off of?
Darryl May. It was the last game of the season. Me and
Victor. He's a lefty, wasn't he?
Yeah. Me and Victor Martinez went back to back.
That's interesting. You said it's the last.
Victor can rake. Oh, please.
Wait, I'm sorry, go ahead.
You say it's the last game of the season, right?
Last game of the season.
September 18th was, right? So so technically, you could hit a home run in your last major league game ever played.
Yeah, if I didn't get called up with the Red Sox and play one game with them, yeah.
Okay. So it was. Wow. So in the last game of the season, you went back-to-back with Victor. Were you before him or after him in the lineup?
Oh, gosh. I think I was before him.
Just say after. You were protecting him.
Yeah, no, I definitely
we won't look it up.
He needed no protection. He needed no protection.
He was Victor a pro. I remember when he was at the Red Sox.
He was awesome.
Okay, so do you remember? You got the count. Like, it's baseball players are like golfers. They get this memory that's like steel trap. Can you just take us through it really quick?
I don't remember the count, to be honest with you, because it was one of those things where, you know, I knew the season was winding down. You know, it was. I wanted so badly to hit a home run. You know, we're at Jacobs Field. I don't even know what it's called now, but yeah, it was like left center field, probably about, I don't know, 8 or 10 rows back, maybe.
Did you get
got me to it.
I'm so sorry, Matt.
Yep, it's I got the ball. The there was an usher out there, and the person that caught it, I don't know who they are, but I thank them tremendously right now. It's
you didn't have to trade anything for it or anything?
I didn't. I think they gave some of Jim Thome's stuff to him, so to make it worthwhile.
You didn't give nothing up, and you got your first home run.
Yeah, Jim was awesome, but and I think that was part of the bartering. You know, I mean, I signed a ball or something like that.
I've heard that about Jim Thome, by the way. I heard he's a great teammate. His teammates all loved him. Did you have an awareness that might be like you might not ever get back? That might be your only home run, or were you optimistic and feeling good after finishing the season like that?
Well, I wasn't too optimistic about. I was optimistic in the sense that I got to where I wanted to be, and then ending the season there, and then trying to figure out what my next move was after that, you know, or try to do what I can to stay with the Indians and see where they were going, because they were rebuilding at that time.
Right.
You know,
had a lot of trades. It was a good spot for you, right?
And looking back on it, maybe. Once I became a free agent after I got done with the Sox organization, it might have been a better opportunity to sign over there as a free agent than it would be for me to sign with the Rays. But those are tough decisions that you got to make at the time when you know you're trying to get on a major league roster and get to that point. But I have, like I said, I have no regrets about where I went and anything.
You talk about the 2002 season and you were playing with Jim Thome on the Indians. Now, you got to bat against Pedro, right?
Yes.
And you got a hit off him.
No.
You didn't. You didn't get a hit off him?
No, not
but you got
to
bat against him.
Yeah.
You remember
I got
that?
A couple of bats against him. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
my first at bat against him, I got 3-0. We were in Fenway. I got 3-0 on him.
Ooh.
And Joel Skinner was our third base coach, and I looked at Joel, and he just, go ahead, swing away. I'm like, oh, man, I'm going to come out of my shoes against Pedro. And he starts to get into his windup, and I'm coming out of my shoes. And I'm like, I'm not coming out of my shoes against Pedro. What are you, stupid? You know, like, and watch one go right down the middle, you know, because I don't want to be that idiot rookie that falls down swinging and follows a pitch off, and then the next one's in my ear, you know. So 3-1, he throws the same exact pitch, and I flew out to center.
Well, he didn't strike out.
Well, the thing about Pedro is like Kerry Wood, though, like, because he has so many dangerous pitches, the thing I found, and I'm not as you know, I don't know as much about baseball as you, but that if you, there's some pitchers you can reasonably kind of figure out what might come next. But with like Pedro and like a Kerry Wood, you don't know what they're going to throw.
Well, both of those guys too have such filthy stuff that it doesn't matter if you know if it's coming or not. You know, it's just, you know, Pedro, I think one year had, was ranked by the by his peers as having the best fastball, changeup, and breaking ball in the major leagues in the same year. And so those guys, when they when he's throwing that ball 3-0, he's throwing it right down the middle, hoping that I try to put it in play, you know. And if I get him, then, oh, well. But
yeah, the chances are so slim that you are, though.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's just it's one of those things. He's throwing hard, but he's it was straight, and it was hittable. It's just – you get underneath it by just a hair, and you fly out the center.
All right, there's a bunch of stuff we want to get to. I want you to – so we're at the end of the 0-2 season. You hit a home run in the final game. Great story. And then what happens next year?
Then I was with the Indians through that the end of the offseason, and then they took me off of the 40-man roster. So, you know, I got designated.
Does that mean you become a free agent?
No. So what happens is you are basically on a list of players. And so how the teams finish the year before determines the queue, basically, of who gets first crack. And so once somebody gets designated, the worst team has the first pick, you know, and so they pass on you. And then second and third and all the way down. Well, the Red Sox were one of the last teams on that list. And they picked me up, claimed me, knowing that the 28 teams before them already passed. So then they flipped me around and put me back on waivers. And then I passed through all the way. And once you pass through all the way, now I'm still a part of that team, but I don't have to be kept on the 40-man roster. I'm just part of their organization now.
Hmm. So they took a gamble that everyone will pass again.
Yeah. And it wasn't even a gamble.
Right,
it was
common
sense. Yeah, common sense kind of thing. You know, no one's going to pick you up again. So that's how I ended up with the Sox for the last, for the 03 and 04
seasons.
So you're
in Pawtucket playing for the Sox?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Would you grow up a what?
Sox fan.
You were?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So was that, what was it like when you went to the team, and was it hard to be in all of 03 sitting in Pawtucket without a call?
Well, it was interesting because, like, yeah, I played an all-star game in high school at Fenway, you know. And then I thought that was going to be my last time, and then I did it in college, and I thought that was going to be the last time, and then with the Indians. So to get picked up by the Red Sox and have the dream that you were going to be able to play in Fenway one day for them, you know, I enjoyed it. I got to see a lot of family and friends. They would come up to the games at Pawtucket. So that was a good part of it. The tough part was that you're playing in an organization that basically said, we lacking talent in our upper levels of the minor leagues. That's why we picked you up. Okay. Well, it kind of tells you where you're at. Not to mention the fact that team's full of all-stars and, you know, those guys that were up there already. So, you know,
Well, the 0-3 team arguably might have been better than the 0-4 team.
Yeah.
And they didn't win it.
Yeah. Well, in one swing.
Yeah. Yeah. They were something. And going to spring training with those guys in 03 and 04, it was eye opening. You know, it was fun to talk hitting with guys that were up there, you know, and that's ultimately what I like to do. You know, I wasn't a defensive guy. You know, I wasn't going to sit there and talk fielding with whoever. I wanted to hit, and I wanted to learn how to hit, and I wanted to talk to these guys, and they were great, all of them.
All right, so you spend the whole 03 in the minors, and then, and again, this is Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports. Episode 68, John Senecal, Brian Chapman here with Earl Snyder, who was a major leaguer born and raised in Connecticut, where we record, and now a police officer in Connecticut, and he's just gracing us with these great stories. And so you go into 04, and I don't know if you want to tell us what happened there, but you want to take us all the way through the call-up. I mean, take it where you want. I mean, you spent a full year in the minors. You know you're just sort of roster depth for the minors, right? I mean, you had no expectation that you might get a call?
Well, that's the thing. Like a lot of the numbers that, you know, I put up for a while there in the minor leagues were good. You know, you lead the league in this or you lead the league in that. And again, that's not to be braggadocious or anything, but that 04 year, I couldn't have hit any better in the minor leagues. Average wise, whatever, it's like 265 or I can't remember what I hit, but you know, ultimately I had 80 extra base hits, I think.
Wow.
You know, 43 doubles. I had 36 home runs, you know, 100 and something RBIs, like Breck, you know, when Wade Boggs' doubles a record in Pawtucket, you know, and tied the home run record. And so at that point, I was hoping for a September call up, maybe, you know,
when the roster expanded.
As a good job down there for the whole year, you grinded it out, whatever. But I ended up getting called up in, I think it was like the second week of August, to kind of caddy for those guys up there if they needed anything, because everyone was getting hurt. So, you know, the joke was that Dale Swain was running everybody into sprained ankles at home plate, and whether it happened, that was the reason or not.
But. Wendell Kim was gone by then.
Now you get called up. Now when you get called up, you play one game and then you're back down, or are you with the team and you only get into one game?
I was there for a little less than a week, I think. I ended up flying to Chicago for a series we were playing against the White Sox, but ended up getting sent back because I can't remember if it was like Mark Bellhorn came off the DL. Somebody came off the DL. Anyway, so I was up there for about a week, but I got to play one game for the Sox in Fenway.
So talk to us about that game. You got a hit in that game.
Got it. Yeah, I got a standing ovation, really.
Get out, really?
Yeah, it was crazy because Boston
fans. Was your family and everything up there?
Yeah. But Boston fans are the best, you know.
They know.
I love them, and they know. And they knew that I was a local kid. They knew I was a Sox fan growing up. You know, when you're in Pawtucket, they're very plugged into that place.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was one of those things where I was 0 for 3, and, you know, I can't remember the count, maybe 2-1, and I stepped out to look, and I look around, and, like, everyone's standing. And I'm like, you got to be kidding me. These people are actually cheering for me in this game that really meant nothing. We already had, you know, but it was just, like, wanting you to get a hit. And
I might have been there, for all I know.
And got a hit in between short and third. And Dale Swaim got somebody thrown out by about 60 feet for the third out of the inning. And Dale runs over to get my helmet because I was running towards second. And he goes, man, I was trying to get you your first RBI. I was like, dude, I took care of that like 2 years ago. Like, we're good. Don't start running any more people into getting hurt, you know, like or running into outs for me, you know. Like, and I appreciate it, but we don't need to do that anymore.
Did you get the ball? So. You get that ball too?
That one, no. Mm-hmm. It wasn't your first hit, so it's just.
Yeah, it's not as.
Got my first hit, but not that one, no.
So then they sent you down, and you didn't get called up when rosters expanded.
No, it was that was probably the most frustrating thing that I went through as far as thinking at that point, I can't hit any better than I did.
Yeah.
You know, I can't. There's nothing else I can possibly do offensively better than what I just did, and I can't even get a call up in September.
Did management or your agent get an answer?
I talked to Theo a little bit, Epstein, you know, and he was just like, you know, we got room here. They were planning on making a run in the playoffs and all that other stuff. And they wanted to keep the camaraderie of what it was, you know, the bench and the behind the scenes kind of stuff. And, you know, agree or not, I understand that. And I was not a person that's going to be, you know, detrimental to anybody there or a distraction to anyone. So, you know, that was tough. I did get a call. I got a call from him because I was technically their property until, I can't remember the date, and sometime in October, I think, after the World Series and everything. But Bill Miller was third baseman at the time. Yeah. And they're like, hey, Billy's knee is a mess. And we're not sure if he's going to be able to make it to this round of the playoffs. Have you been throwing and hitting and stuff? And are you ready to come up if we need you kind of thing? Because we still actually technically have the rights to you. Sure.
Yeah, of course. You're
like, no.
It's like, I haven't done anything in 3 weeks, but it's like, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, but that call obviously never came, and that was the end of that.
So you watch him go to win the World Series in 04.
I was in the Dominican, actually. I was playing winter ball down there, so I was watching it with subtitles, but yeah.
But in the end, it's not a total loss because you actually get something out of that World Series. Talk to us a little bit about you play one game for the Red Sox, and what do you get?
Yeah, you got
other than memories for life. But.
Well, yeah, you got those are great too. Yeah, I got it. Ended up getting a World Series ring from them.
You did.
Yeah, stole it. I can say I stole it because it's.
No man, you earned it.
Yeah, yeah. It's statute of limitations is over with that, but it's. Yeah, it was one of those things where everybody on the active roster was given a ring. And
now, did you know that was going to happen, or was that just something all of a sudden?
It was rumor.
Hey, honey, there's something in this weird box just showed up.
You have no idea. That's it. What you just said was, it's funny because I get a call from like somebody in the front office. They're like, hey, yeah, what ring size are you? And I'm like, man, this is a joke. You're not going to get me one. Whatever. Here's my ring size, you know? And so the whole winter goes by, spring training. I end up as a free agent signed with Tampa. And Kristen, my wife, is pregnant with our first kid. And so she goes back home because they can't travel after 8 months. You know, so she goes back home and we have my daughter. And she's at home waiting, and it's a pouring rainy day. And she asked her family, don't ring the doorbell anymore because the baby's sleeping kind of thing. So someone comes in, ding, ding, rings the doorbell. She goes to the door. Pouring rain, and there's just one box just sitting on the stoop. And so she picks it up. She calls me. She's like, hey, did you order any sneakers? Like,
it's this glowing box on the porch.
And I was like, what do you mean I order sneakers? No, because I'm not going to be there for 7 months. And she goes, well, it's something from Boston. And I was like, oh, it's probably the World Series ring that they said they were going to send me, you know, as a joke.
Right.
Sure enough, she opens it up, and it's just laying there on the ground. So it was that was funny. I'm glad she was home. If it wasn't for my daughter, that thing would have been there for
a
7 months out.
Porch Pirates would have got it.
Seriously. Yeah.
You would have been chasing them down.
Yeah, unbelievable.
We're talking with Earl Snyder here on Fanbase, the Deep Diver in the Greatest Rivalry in Sports. John Senecal, Brian Shackman here. Earl played for the Red Sox one game in 2004 and got a World Series ring, had a great career. And so where's that ring now?
It's in my pocket, actually.
Okay, really? You brought it for us?
Brought it for you. Yeah, you what?
Can I see
it? I got a question yesterday. And
yeah, I asked him if he got the ring first. I wasn't too sure if he did.
And this is like, because they do like replica rings for some staff. This is it. The same ring you got is the same one that Big Poppy got?
Yeah, I'm sure his is a little bit bigger just because his hands were bigger. But, yeah. You know, it's players' rings are different than front office and you know, management scouts kind of thing.
That's amazing.
From what I understand, I don't think I've ever really seen.
That's a good question because you know Bobby Dickerson, he got one with the Diamondbacks, but he didn't get the actual one that like you know Luis Gonzalez
right,
got.
But he was a player,
that's a good question though because most people would think you know oh I got a World Series ring, but there's different versions. So this is the real hardware. So
that's what the player ring looks like. That's
you ever wear it?
No.
Where does it stays in your sock drawer?
It's just it's in the safe, and it's just you know it's.
I mean, it's one of those things where like you're proud of it, but like you also don't want to be that guy walking around with it. You know, walking into the package store with your ring, and so somebody can say, "Hey, where'd you get that?"
It's
not your personality,
not even close. And it's one of those things too, is because you know that's why I said like I stole it. You know, you're there for one game, you play one game, you get one hit in some game that really didn't matter much in mid-August, you know, and to think that I could parlay that into this, it was comical, you know, and it was a joke for a while between me and my wife, and you know, I was like, they're never going to send that. There's no way, you know, it's only one game, but right, that's sure enough.
So that's where you sit. From where I sit, and maybe I don't want to speak for John, and this is where the Moonlight Graham, it's like, I know you didn't appreciate it when you were there. But you made it. I talked the story. We've had Rico Bronya on the show, and I've known Rico a long time. I dated his sister before I met my wife. You know, he had a terrible stint with the Red Sox. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there was all these things where I think he told the story where they wanted to send him down and he had to agree to it. And he said, no.
No. Yep.
And then he goes out and he hits a grand slam, a walk-off grand slam to win a game. And like, no matter what happens, even though it ended really in disappointment there, like, he got that. Like you put that uniform on, you went on that field, and you got a hit. I mean, I'm sorry. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it also speaks to everything that goes before that, too. You know, like, we talk about this stupid labor agreement and all that, and I've always said they don't care about the minor leaguers. I mean, you were trudging it out. You were sleeping on your cots and all that stuff. Like, you put your work in. Like you even said, you started in college, and you put your work in. So, you know, It's awesome. It really is. I mean, there's no part of me that doesn't think you didn't earn that ring.
Yeah, no. I look back at it now, and I truly appreciate it more than I did at the time, because at the time you couldn't really see the forest through the trees, right? You're in there trying to do the job that you want to do and get to the place you want to be, and you're not really understanding the level. I mean, you know, you look back at it now, there's 700 players, you know, and you're one of them.
Yeah,
that's on one of those rosters. It is an accomplishment. It's just one of those things where at the time, I want more. I want more time up there. I want more games.
But there's nothing wrong with that either.
Yeah.
No, but John and I can speak to this, because that's where I think the hardest part is. And where we started the conversation is that that line between being an everyday major leaguer and not getting that opportunity. It's just like me. Like, I thought I was good enough to host the Today Show, and I still think I'm talented enough, but I never got the chance. Or one thing broke the other way. I mean, John's been, you know, he's been media most of his adult life too, and it's not always a straight meritocracy. And so to rake in AAA and get, you know, you're not a prospect anymore, right? You're Crash Davis, and you know, but it's true.
Yeah.
And so. I think people can relate to that frustration of not thinking you're good enough and not getting that opportunity is something a lot of people can relate to.
Yeah, absolutely. 125%.
Yeah, there was a little bit of time where I was quote unquote labeled a 4A player, from what I understand.
Yeah.
So it was like purgatory, right? You were a little bit better than the guys in AAA, but you were not quite good enough to stick in the big leagues, but you're somewhere in the middle, you know, and could fill in every once in a while if needed, but for the most part, we're just going to keep you down there and you know, wait for you to be needed up here, and it's not going to stick, and then you can go back down. So, and then every year that goes by, you know, your clock is ticking,
yeah.
You know, because, you know, you get to 26, 27, 28, you go from prospect to this ain't happening, my guy, and that's it, you know, so.
Just real quick, can you put a ribbon on the career then? So that was your last appearance in the majors, and after 2004, you get let go. You end up in Tampa, and just take us to the end of the career.
Yeah, so 2005, that was the first year I was an actual free agent where I could sign wherever. That's where I talk about maybe I should have gone back to Cleveland, maybe not, who knows. But ended up playing 2005 with Tampa in Durham, North Carolina, and then signed the next year with the Reds, was with them for a couple years, and then finished out half a season in Charlotte with the White Sox organization.
When did you know you were never going to make it back up?
It was right around that 2005 season where I just hit, like I said, as good as I could have. I couldn't have put up better numbers that season with the 04 Pawtucket year and not get called up. And then 05, I was told that, you know, Lou Piniella was the manager of the Rays. And, yeah, he wants to see a hit in spring training and this and that. And, okay, oh, okay. You know, so I signed with them. I got 3 at-bats in spring training and then sent back down to minor league camp. So at that point, it's just, you know, it gets to that point where you figure – what else do I have? There's nothing else that I can really do, I don't think, aside from hit 75 home runs and that's not going to happen, you know, to get over that hump. So
I got a bunch of questions, John, but I've been dominating. You got something you want to jump in on?
I'm just interested, you know, you talked about, you know, doing it the right way. And, you know, there's a lot of guys that could have been in your position that said, you know, I'm going to steer myself the opposite direction, you know, and do the PEDs and all that. And I'm sure that could have probably been an option for you. I don't know.
Oh, definitely.
But, you know, that I think that speaks volumes to, you know, your character, and it speaks volumes, you know, probably what you're doing in your life now and the kind of person you are. So, you know, I commend you for that, too. I'm sure that was a big part. You know, it's not an easy decision to make, I guess, is what I'm saying. You know, you could very easily took the other route.
Oh, definitely. I can.
Why didn't you?
I never thought it would benefit me to the point where it was going, because everyone gets to this PED talk where it's you're going to hit the ball into the ocean like Barry Bonds. You know, Barry was hitting balls like that for a decade before any of that. The PEDs a lot of guys were taking them, or they started taking them because they were hurt and they were coming back from an injury and they wanted to get on the field sooner so they can prove themselves quicker and all right. that. Some guys liked the way they looked on the beach and they took them. For me, it was one of those things where I had enough power, I thought, where it's, well, who cares if I hit an extra six home runs? It's not going to make a difference, you know? It's not like I'm hitting balls.
I'll just tell you, some people have the opposite calculus, that if you go to arbitration and you have six more home runs, that translates into X amount of dollars.
Yeah, but I was the furthest thing from arbitration you can imagine. So it's like when you're coming up in the minor leagues, you know, certain guys were taking them, sure, you know, because they wanted more power, because they're hitting 12 home runs a year, not 26, you know. And so it was one of those things, and it was never going to make me faster. I was never going to be somebody that steals bases. So that was out. And then you look at the health ramifications from taking that stuff. You know, I don't need to have my liver explode on me when I'm 40, you know? And so taking all that into account, could I have gotten away with it? Absolutely. You know, that was that.
I think that's been proven. You could have gotten away
with it. Yeah. And I mean, if it wasn't for Balco in what, 2003 or whenever it was, or maybe before, I can't even remember when that happened, but teams were just, it was all in-house, you know? So
I got one real serious question before I get to some fun stuff. Is it difficult to become a normal person, like to leave pro sports and then live the, you know, the it's not an average life. You got a wonderful family, you got a really good job, but I mean, what's that? Is that transition difficult?
Yeah, it was difficult, but I thought I ran my time out. Right. Like I played 10 years after college, and it's one of those things where I did everything I could. I did it my way. I did it the way where I can look back and be proud. I can talk to my kids about it and be proud about it. So when my time came and real life was, you know, I had two kids at the time, my wife, and I'm traveling on bus trips going to Rochester, you know, like I'm going to Syracuse. And I'm missing my kids, and I'm you know, every time I see them, they look different because they were smaller. It's done, you know. And you get to that point where the age and the amount of time I'm playing six years in, you know, the international league. You know, you get to the point where you're like, you know, I've had enough. You know, and I was the decision made for me. Was there another team out there that would assign me the next year? I don't even know because I didn't even try. You know, but I've had enough, and that was it. And it was time to move on, because I know in my early 30s, I'm not going to automatically, it's not going to happen.
Right.
You know, so why spend the time going back to Ottawa, you know, to play the Orioles organization or whoever was up there at the time? It's not going
to
happen.
So. Right. You're sitting next on the bus, I'm 22 year old thinking about what strip bar he's going to go to, and you're sad because you can't give your baby a bottle. I mean, it's like,
yeah.
I mean, the bus had left the station.
Oh God, know? yeah, and it was that point where I had enough. I had enough insight to sit there and say and be honest with myself and say, okay, this is going to end. I'm not going to go and play independent ball. I'm not going to do any of that stuff. It's been a good run, and I made it further than I ever thought I was going to, and I'm happy with it, you know, and making the decision was easy for me. It wasn't for a lot of guys I know.
Right.
You know, it was rough for them, you know, guys coming out of high school that never went to college that, you know, all of a sudden they play 8 years and now the only thing that they have on their resume is that they
played baseball.
Yeah.
But you had a degree.
Yep.
And what?
Criminal justice.
And now you wind up leaving baseball. And, and now is that an easy decision to become a police officer, or is that, how does that all unfold?
I mean, I always wanted to do something like that. And at the time, it was out of necessity, too. You know, I mean, it's like when you look at your resume and you, you know, worked part time for FedEx on the off seasons. And,
right.
You know, you worked at a liquor store in the off seasons just to kind of make a little extra money. And then all of a sudden you're putting that stuff on a resume. You know, and I hit a ball with a stick for 10 years. It doesn't equate to much, but fortunately I was hired on a PD down in Raleigh, North Carolina. And, you know, I'm grateful for that opportunity.
And then you get the opportunity to come back home.
Yes. Yeah. That, and it's, that's been the greatest decision I've made, I think. I not like I made it. Kristen made it with me, but it was difficult. But it was looking back on it now, it was absolutely the best decision to make. And kids are great, and they're happy, and they're healthy, and I can't complain one bit about it.
You know, it's funny because part of me is like, there's plenty of minor league players who became great major league managers and coaches. But then I'm thinking about what you're saying is it doesn't make sense, because you would have had at least 4 years on the buses as a coach before you got any call up, and then you're still gone for half the year.
So you're married to that sport.
Is that why you didn't go into baseball after baseball?
Oh, yeah, because I was asked, you know, my agent at the time, you know, before everything was done, was just like, would you ever coach? I was like, there's no way that I'm going back down to the bottom of the list as a hitting coach in A ball, you know, driving around 12 and 14 hour bus trips, making, I don't even know what they make, but I'm sure it wasn't enough to support a family back somewhere else where they're living. And and then you're traveling all the time again on those bus trips. And it's, I already read that book. I'm good. Yeah. You know, like this, I'm not going to go back to that. So that was never really even an option. I wasn't going to do that. You know, kids sports and things like that, when my stupid schedule dictates where I can be there for them, great, you know, and I try to be as much as possible. But I was never in the running for that coaching.
All right, so we're going to wrap it up here. A couple quick questions. Best player you ever on the field with?
I liked Manny. He was like watching him hit, and getting to hit with him in spring training and pick his brain and ask him some questions.
You could talk to him? You actually could talk to him? Like, have a conversation with him?
Oh, he's awesome. Yeah, really? Yeah. Well, my first year with the Red Sox, I'm at 2003. It's like a new team. And I said, I'm going to be the first one to show up to spring training, and I'm going to work my butt off and blah, blah, blah. And it's like 6:30 in the morning. I get out of my car, and there's the empty lot, parking lot.
Man,
and
we're sleeping on the bench out front.
Stretches at 9 o'clock or 9:30 or whatever it was. And I hear like somebody hitting in the cage already. I'm like, what in the world, man? And I walked over, and there's 60 balls on the ground. And Manny's full sweat. And he's like, Poppy, hurry up. I need a break. And I was like, yeah, I'll be right there, man. It's like, I run in, and, you know, I get a chance to hit with him before anything. And because I don't think he picked up a bat before spring training. And so he got into his groove there, but you know, got to hit with him like that and ask questions and kind of pick his brain. He was great. He was a great hitter. You know, I don't know about all around best player, right. You know, but he was fun to watch. I enjoyed him a lot watching him hit.
How about the, can you tell us like the biggest jerk?
I don't know if I would want to throw. Okay. There was
how about most overrated?
There was one guy. He was.
I love this stuff.
Milton Bradley wasn't very nice.
The outfielder for Cleveland.
Yeah, yeah. He was. He was great one day, and then he'd come in and he would snap the next day, and you're like, what is going on?
I wonder if he took a lot of crap for his name growing up, Milton Bradley.
Of course he did.
And he just was taking it out on everybody.
I don't know about all that. He was a stud, man.
He was a strong kid.
Such a good athlete, a good player, switch hitter. He was awesome. It's just like he couldn't get out of his own way to maximize his potential.
Was Albert Bell still there, or was he gone?
No, Albert.
Don't
Albert
call me Bell Joey.
Albert, I would have loved to have seen him. No, my year, the year in 2002 when I was there, that was the year that they started trading everybody off. So, you know, go up to Bartolo got traded that year to the Expos, and we got back Cliff, Lee, Brandon, Phillips, and I never played with Grady Sizemore, but he was like a lower, younger guy. But the other two, you know, they came right to Buffalo, and, you know, we traded somebody. I can't remember who we traded for. Coco Crisp, Covelli came over at that point, and we got a bunch of, they got a bunch of young guys that year for the older guys that, because they were just breaking it down. You know, they were just completely revamping that system.
I was going to say, like, in the minors, who's the guy that, you know, you saw him for a half an hour and you're like, he's gone. He's so good. He's gone.
I saw Glenn Allen Hill hit one over the light tower in Syracuse once at a game.
Yeah.
And I was like, it literally, like, never looked like it was going to land.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a few of those guys. Like David Wright. I remember playing against David Wright when I, you know, for the 15 minutes he was in AAA. Got to play him in Norfolk, and it was just like you looked at him, you're like, okay, he's got it together. Like everything he does, he's got it together. There are a bunch of guys like that, though. Yeah. You know, a bunch of guys that you faced. Like I remember we faced Francisco Liriano when he was younger with the Twins in Rochester, and he blew us all up.
Filthy.
Oh,
filthy.
My God, his slider was ridiculous, and he carved us up. 1 year in Rochester. I don't even know what team I was playing for because I played in that league so long. But it was like when we did face him, he killed us.
And you could tell more stories. Listen, I know how grateful John is for you.
Do you remember your first major league hit?
Oh yeah.
Who was it off? I know. I think I wrote it down. But
yeah, Hideki Arabi.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
Former Yankee, but it wasn't against the Yankees though, right?
No, he was closing. Texas. He was closing for Texas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I got to give credit to Ellis Burks for that because Ellis was our DH and I was pinch hitting for another Connecticut guy, John McDonald. And before I got up, he goes, hey, if you get to 3-2, he's going to throw that split finger, but it's going to be just this piece of crap right down the middle. He's going to throw it like a changeup. He goes, sell out, man. He goes, that's what's going to happen. I was like, okay. And I got to 3-2, and I'm like, well, Ellis has been here longer than I have, so I'm gonna go with it. And sure enough, he throws that stupid split finger changeup right down the middle and hit a ground ball up the middle for a base hit. And
that's awesome.
Yeah, it was so cool. And it's like, you know, I get to first base, and Palmeiro says congratulations, you know. And then the next ball was grounded out to first. Matt Lawton was hitting behind me, and he just rolled one over to first, and it was the end of the game because there was two outs, and I was 3-2 count. And, you know, it was like Sunday night baseball game of the week, right? And so on that ground ball, I'm running to second, and, you know, A-Rod's there. It smells like cologne for some reason. After a nine-inning game, I didn't understand it.
That doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, but, you know, he says congratulations and all that other stuff because they all know, you know. Yeah. They know. They're like, well, who the hell is this guy, you know? And, oh, it's his first hit, and they throw the ball in, so...
So I remember Hideki Arabu. I'm working for the Rochester Red Wings right out of college, and he's pitching there on his way up to the Yankees. This is probably 97, maybe 98. And he was the real deal. You know, everyone was making a big deal out of him. And I'm walking underneath the tunnel, and I look to my right, and he's sitting on top of a washing machine with a blazer in his mouth, smoking a cigarette before his start. So you want to talk about conditioning and, you know, so Steinbrenner was right, I guess, when they called him the fat toad.
Yeah.
Yeah. May he rest in peace.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I'd love to talk to you about so many other things, and maybe we'll have you on again. I mean, we're just grateful for the time. It's awesome. And we also think it's great that you should be recognized. I mean, this is great. And you're in our backyard here in Connecticut. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's great. And it's great to finally meet you guys and talk to you like this, but yeah, anytime. I'm around, not going anywhere. So
he's Earl Snyder. Don't get into trouble in East Hampton, Connecticut, because he will take you down. He's John Senecal. He's now, you're back in the business. You're working in the media world full time now.
In the business, yeah.
Working for Fox.
Fellow TIC.
Yeah.
Yeah, the other side of the television side.
And I'm Brian Shackman. This is Fan Base, a deep dive into the greatest rivalry in sports, episode 68. Obviously, if you're watching us on YouTube or listening to us wherever, please share, please like, and we will talk to you next time.
Jenna Fisher.
And I'm Angela Kinsey.
And together we have the podcast Office Ladies.
Just because we finished rewatching The Office does not mean we're going anywhere.
Every Wednesday, we'll be sharing even more exclusive stories from The Office and our friendship with brand new guests. Plus, you can revisit all the Office Ladies rewatch episodes every Monday with new bonus tidbits before every episode.
So follow and listen to Office Ladies on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.